Okay, we're burning film here, guys. And I'm Wilson Lai.
I'm Benjamin Yap.
I'm Eli Sands.
You're listening to Deep Cut.
On Deep Cut, we compare a director's most popular film with a personal favorite chosen by one of us.
We also discuss that director's life and career to bring in context that helps us view their movies as they may want us to.
Welcome to another episode of Deep Cut Upkeep, a third one that we're recording in a row.
Oh, whoa.
In like a span of 1 week. Wow, look at this pace. We are back.
Look at us go. We're flying, guys.
The movies
we're
are
running
so
a
bad.
Podcast. I mean, the reason we haven't recorded is because we've had 69 episodes up for a while and we just wanted it that way.
Yeah, that's exactly the reason.
That's
the
only
reason
why we've been off.
Not job, life. No, no.
Wilson's unwillingness to edit.
Calling himself
okay,
out.
No one said that.
Blowing up his own spot.
Today we're covering Hirokazu Koreeda's Monster, which came out in 2023. And it's still opening and still playing in some territories, I think. I think Singapore is still playing it, Hong Kong is still playing it, and I think US just got a wide release quite recently. And Koreeda was the very first director that we covered on this podcast, which is because he's a favorite of all three of us.
Full circle.
And yeah, well, full circle. We kind of skipped out on a little film called Broker.
Well, you guys didn't. I just didn't watch it.
Yeah, we just didn't talk about it.
And we also skipped out on a little Netflix show.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the TV's understandable, right?
Yes, it is.
But the film, I mean, Broker is a little bit of a deep cut pick for some people, probably.
Which is why we should have covered it.
Yeah, not like it's the name of our
show.
Yeah,
but no one really cared about that movie, and also I didn't.
I cared about IU.
I love IU.
I love IU. We're doing Korean finger hearts.
And I don't know what you are talking about.
Anyway, before we begin this episode, be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. Like us, leave us a review so that more people can discover the show. And if you want to come talk to us about movies, you can come join us on our Discord server as well. So let's begin. Let's talk about Monster, which is the name of like 100 movies, but this movie is very different from those other movies.
How so? No, I'm just kidding. Don't answer that.
I can answer it. It's obvious. Like, I think there's a, I can't remember, there's like a Charlize Theron movie called Monster.
Yes.
Yeah, about a real life killer.
I have a friend whose short film is also called Monster, I think. Yeah, there's a lot of films called Monster. So, who's going to begin? Because, okay.
Why don't we plot summarize?
Real talk. I saw this in July and it's been a long time and I don't remember much. I remember some stuff. But Wilson just saw it today for the second time. So maybe you want to talk about what the film's about and what you thought about it. And then I'll jump in when I can remember stuff.
Thanks, Ben, for putting me on the spot.
Yeah.
Well, we can do our general reactions, which can be spoiler-free, but I think as soon as we start talking about this movie, we're going to just dive into spoiler territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the sort of, I guess, non-spoilery plot summary is, this is a film about a young boy who has problems at school, and his mom's trying to figure something out, and he's acting out and having issues with his school teacher, and it sort of becomes a Rashomon-esque story where we view this child through three different perspectives. First, the mom's perspective, and then secondly, the teacher that he's accusing of abusing him in the classroom, and lastly the son Minato's own perspective. And through these three versions of the story, we get to understand these characters a little more, and I guess our preconceived notions get challenged. That's a very broad way of speaking about the plot of this film. In terms of general reactions, I saw this first in June this year when it was preview screening in Hong Kong, and I think it really blew me away. I think it was definitely up there with Koreeda's best. I sort of am realizing that I prefer Koreeda working with other screenwriters. Well, that's not necessarily true, but the two films that he has not written that I have watched and loved are Maburoshi and this film. And I think he does stellar job in interpreting like other people's styles of writing into his own work and sort of just doing making it still his own film. I think the performances are fantastic. I thought it was really moving. I thought the score, which is by Ryuichi Sakamoto, is incredible. And I think as we go into the different parts of the film, I became more and more engaged as I was like trying to figure out what was going on. And then the last section really hit me in the feels like big time the first time I watched it, because I had no clue what I was going into. And I think that's what made the second watch, I don't know, I feel like it didn't pack as big of a punch for me. I think I was sitting through quite a lot of the first and second bits being like, oh, I'm waiting to get to that third section.
Right.
Which is why I think I docked it half a star in my rewatch. Ooh. Which does affect my year-end rankings, because for like half of the year, it was my number one.
Whoa,
and I think this really like shook things up. But I do think it's still really emotionally powerful, but I do think it sort of suffers from Koreeda just making formal choices that feel a little normal or like by the books. And then you just, we can talk about this when we talk about our year-end list, but I think when you put it up against other films this year, or even other films in his filmography, like I think about the intentionality of something like Mabaroshi, which was so early in his career. Well, I think in particular, like shot choices.
Wow, you've confirmed what I said in my first reaction to this film, which is that I thought that a second watch would be less rewarding than you would think.
Huh.
Because of the way it's structured, because of the Rashomon thing. Because that's my impression when I watched it the one time, that style of narrative doesn't help you go into it properly the second time, because you already know the ending. And so that kind of melodramatic reveal doesn't hold any water once you know the whole story, which is fine for like the for experience kind of thing. But I think then as like a story, just like a story, not like a experience, it's kind of falters in the way it's told.
Yeah.
Which is my main gripe with the film, which is this narrative structure. I don't like it. I don't even have particularly fun thoughts about Rashomon as well. I wish that this film was just done in a different way, because I think that third act with the child's perspective is so strong that I wish it was the whole film.
Yeah.
That's really just my main kind of point when it comes to this film.
To me, I agree that my favorite passage is the final one, and I, in principle, see the utility of structuring the movie the way that it is structured, right? Where I think part of why that third chapter carries more punch is because you are held at such a distance beforehand.
Right.
And I get that the point is that these adults are not able to see what we eventually learn about the relationship between Minato and Yori. And to me, it does work better in principle than in execution, where some of the functioning of the school as like a business and administration and some of the parenting is conveniently unable to reach Minato.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a melodrama, so I know that that's part of the deal. And in order to make its point, it needs some allowance of convenience. And at the same time, and, you know, maybe this is what I'm bringing in as a teacher as well, there were some points when I was like, come on, like really?
Yeah.
That they should have noticed and rather than like not noticed.
Like there's so many times when he's out of the classroom, or like he could have just said to the mom, it was an accidental elbowing while your son was throwing things. Like,
yeah,
I get the whole point that it makes at one point. You know, the principal says, like, you know, you are going to defend the school right now. It's like a touch too obfuscated. Like they could have just explained something.
That's the thing, the obfuscation in this film that is in there to maintain its Rashomon structure is working against it.
I agree.
In a very odd way. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about, Wilson, where the aesthetic choices are not there to show you that the people don't see it. It's to stop you, the audience, from seeing it.
From seeing it, yeah.
So I'm like, they don't notice, or you're making it so that I can't see. And so I feel like those are not aligned very well here. Because there's a version of this where you show the situation and you show how they missed it, but the audience doesn't have to be kept in the dark the whole time, right? But I get with this structure, you're supposed to say that, oh, you know, from all three angles, the audience also sees and has a different experience. But I think the alignment of the experience of the character and the experience of the audience is not quite right. And then something just feels a little off. So I feel this directorial hand of like, oh, I'm just going to cover this part of the screen so you don't see it. That's the feeling I get when I'm watching the film. And that is so apparent in each section before the last one that it's off-putting. Where it feels like something is being kept from me, the audience, very purposefully. So I'm just waiting for you to tell me what it is that you haven't told me. Rather than it being something that I don't know, but I don't know that I don't know it as I'm watching it. You know what I mean?
I do.
Like, it leaves a trail of questions as it goes along.
You're like, why are they not? Something is wrong here. Like, you know something is missing, and that's the problem. Yeah. Like, you shouldn't feel like something is missing from each story.
Like, when talking about the administration and the educators' side of things, I think that this could be seen as like a critique of the education system and how it fails students, or it's also definitely a critique of Japanese society as a whole and how insensitive or like how it makes it really hard for queer people to come out because you are in such a society that is so oppressive in that kind of way. But I also can see that, I don't know, like with characters like the principal, which sort of does semi get fleshed out but isn't given enough time to like explain herself. Like, I think that was also fine with having her as sort of like an evil driving force for most of it. And I also do think, like, in Japan, like, students like these do like slip through the cracks. And I think people in those sort of educator roles, like, sometimes don't do a good job.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, Wilson. I think its goal is to make that kind of broader social critique. I think where it misses is that because of those dodgy details about the working of the administration, it too easily becomes about how these specific people failed rather than the overarching system around them.
Right.
There are a couple of points when it does talk about how the merit system works in Japanese schools, or, you know, the mom imitating the comedian on TV making fun of a man dressing as a woman, and, you know, the teacher saying, like, be a man during the exercises. There are a couple of points when it makes its argument more broadly social, but I think it's too few and far between to really make a full, robust systemic argument, as I think you're saying it should do.
Yeah.
And furthermore, I'm thinking more about what you said a little bit ago about Koreeda's style. And maybe the gentleness and the kind of standard coverage in some places also creates the feeling of a calm world in which there is not pressure to adhere to some social norms.
Right.
I think actually the structure of a thriller works against its argument, and the style of a gentle drama also works against its argument.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think he was definitely like, I don't know how the process of him acquiring the script was, but he was definitely chosen specifically for that third section because works well with children and is good at like presenting this sort of like alternate beautiful reality that children like live in. And those are like his like hallmarks. And then I think the other stuff, I think he handles decently. Like, I did feel, at least with the first time watching it, I was really intrigued. And I think, especially that first section, I think Sakura Ando just does all the heavy lifting for him.
Yeah, totally.
And her sort of growing desperation and are also growing desperation because both, like, she as a character and us as viewers have no clue what's going on. Like, literally, like, we're just left in the dust. Like, we have no idea what's happening.
Yeah.
But I think Ando's so good in that first section that it makes it fine. But I think it's that second section that is like struggles to find a grip.
Yeah.
Because I think the first section also, Koreeda does that like he knows how to do that kind of like melodrama where things are going wrong as well.
Yeah, it feels not as well researched in the second section even.
Mm-hmm.
And like everything with the school, she hits a wall with the admin so abruptly and extremely where like right from the jump, they're giving her nothing. And that I find hard.
That's quite shocking.
That's confusing also because when you experience that, you experience it from her perspective of being blocked. But that section is not aligned with her. That section is aligned with other people.
Huh.
But you feel blocked like she is blocked. So it's a confusing construction of like, who am I with right now? Because I think the school teacher being the person you're aligned with is also just an odd choice. I wonder if there was somebody else you could have used.
Mm,
you know, like maybe the principal could have been in like another way of doing the admin thing. So then she can process it through like different people telling her different things because she's not there, right? And then that would be a different angle. But because the school teacher is really not interesting as a character and he just is not seeing things, so it's not quite pulling its weight in the middle of the story. And then it just hits this very obvious second act lull that leads you into the third act.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think the first act still functions on its own. I remember still being quite engaged in the first act, even though I was very confused. But the second act really lost me in the kind of experience of it. But we should talk about the third act.
Oh my God. And what a third act. I do think this is like my favorite ending of a Corita film. And it like, I think it just saves it. It saves it. I think it's so incredible. And I think in its like conception of these ideas about queer people being able to create a space for themselves and like found family and just all those notions that are sort of universal to the queer experience, it sort of handles it with such beauty and such care and such gentleness in a way that I think maybe like only Corita could. And just getting to spend time with those two boys in their hideout, in their little special place, was magical.
Great production design.
Yeah.
It feels very genuinely made by children. I'm thinking a lot about how, in addition to creating their own space for themselves, they crucially are the ones who save themselves in the end.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the second chapter, it seems like the teacher and the mother are going to be the ones to save the kids.
Right.
But when they look in the train car, they're not there anymore. And then at the very end of the movie, we see that they found their own way out of the landslide that trapped them in the train car. Right. I think that that is very nice, that it's not forcing a reconciliation or this need to assimilate for the kids who are queer in the end,
right?
That they are the ones who have their own tools and capabilities to make their own life and find their own happiness. And it is euphoric in the end when they are just running through the grasses. It's great.
Mm. It's kind of like the found family kind of thing, right? Like this is just a pair. It's a found family. But I guess I'm trying to think about the other films. I guess Shoplifters, you also get a sense of like the family you leave.
Mm.
And I guess this is kind of like the people, I won't say leave, but like the communities that are not accepting of you or like that you are choosing to be apart from.
Mm.
Yeah.
And choosing the place that you want to go to that actually makes you happy, that actually like you feel a belonging to. So I think that's quite awful.
And I think it doesn't beat around the bush, right? I don't think it does a thing like that, like sort of some shit like Love, Simon does where his parents are like, oh my God, so happy that he came out, and it's like, I don't know, all cheers and everything. Like, I think there is like, even in these kids who are so young, I think there is like a understood reality where they are not going to be accepted in the wider society. Yeah. And I think that like comes to light very clearly to me as an audience member when you have that like montage at the end where Minato like recounts previous times where subtle homophobia or like hetero norm being applied onto him, like I don't know, his dad being a really strong rugby player and his mom telling him in the car, I promised your dad that I will only leave you alone once you get a wife and kids and a family. Yeah.
Right.
And then her laughing at the cross-dresser on the TV.
Yeah.
Like those sort of quick compounding of small events in that last section
right.
really drove home that idea that it's never going to be all right, but they're going to try their best to make it all right for them. And I think that was just magical. It was beautiful.
I guess I think about how like its portrayal of queerness is not something that's, it's quite subtle in a sense, and it's not like a message movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No. I mean, yes, I do know what you mean.
Like, it's very character... it's like a very character-focused thing, and it's not like about necessarily about coming out or like about like the realization of coming to yourself. And because the kids are quite young, and I think even Corey Ada himself talks about like how he kind of was a bit wishy-washy about the queer palm thing, but I think his intent is
he
there.
He won that thing, though.
Yeah, it was confusing, but he said some weird stuff. But anyway, the intent is there in terms of portraying the relationship as being about the two kind of like less masculine boys kind of like finding themselves in each other, I guess, which, do you know what I'm trying to say?
No, I think there's more in the film. I think they're definitely queer. They're not just queer coded. Yeah. I think they're queer.
Yeah, sure. I think the intention is clear, but I'm saying that the approach to it isn't like, this is a queer movie necessarily. Does that make sense?
Right.
Where it's like trying to be like, use that as like part of its marketing or whatever, because it really didn't.
I don't think so, though. I think that was intentional.
Really?
Like, I think they sort of want a Trojan horse.
Oh, sure,
yeah. I think the general public in Japan is still quite homophobic.
That's true.
I think
that's true.
Like, by Trojan horsing or like advertising this as like a new Corey Ada drama, people will get like, I don't know, sucked in. And like, I didn't know at all. Like, I was just like, why are they awarding him the queer palm? Like, of course he did not make a queer movie. Like, I was like, I was confused. But then I saw it.
Maybe that's why it was approached in that way. Like, maybe that's why he had to approach it in that way for the story. That's interesting.
It's interesting for marketing.
A useful term for what's happening in the movie, I'll borrow from Jessica Jung on Letterboxd, her review, which is great and worth a read, and we'll drop a link in the description below. She dubbed it a bittersweet story about the childhood homosocial, parentheses, not sexual, story about the two little ones, Minato and Yori. I think that's useful. Like, it really is a discovery of how these boys want to relate to other people and who they are personally.
Yeah.
I think that distinction's useful.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah. I think it's good to note as well.
Because even if you're a person who doesn't want to read too much into its queerness, it still says something about the ways that men can be like when they're children.
Yeah.
Or that they can grow up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I think is something that I've always wanted to see in general. Like, it's really something like kind of like content that I like a lot, where it's like, I don't know the right term, but it's like soft. Not soft boy. You know what I mean?
No, yeah.
Yeah.
It's sounding very suspicious.
Or like a certain gentleness or tenderness that men or boys should learn, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or need to learn. I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Well, not a question. Like,
yeah.
For something really interesting, because after I watched it, I talked to some people about it, and more than one person had a very bleak view of the ending.
Bleak view?
And
like the running towards a bridge?
That they're dead already?
Yeah, that they're dead, and the scene after the flood is like a dream sequence.
No, come on.
And I don't know why people are so pessimistic.
Get
and
out
I was
of
like,
here.
Why? And I don't think the film is setting that up
no,
for you.
No, I was looking out for it, though.
You were?
I was looking out for it the second time because it was something that I like got an inkling of in the first time, and I don't think Well, after they run out for the first time, Yori asks Minato, "Oh, is this rebirth?" Because that's a thing that they've been talking about a lot through the film, and he says, "Oh, is this rebirth?" And then Minato says to him, "No, this is not. No, this is not. Let's go. Let's run." And then they start running. And so I was like, "Okay, they're like bringing it up and then they're clearing it up." So then that's like out of the question. But then the final shot, you see them running, and in front of them, there's like those abandoned train, like the end of the line train tracks, right?
Yeah.
And when you see it earlier in the film, there's a fence. There's a fence between them and the train tracks that they like lean on. But the last shot, the fence is not there. I don't know what that means.
I don't
like it
that.
Might have been blown away by the fucking wind, but it is clearly not there at the end, and it's there earlier in the film.
Maybe it's a continuity error. Somebody
hopefully it's a massive, heavy ass continuity error.
I obviously do not like that option as an ending.
Sure.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I like to believe that they're alive.
Yeah. I'm going to push past my distaste for that option of an ending and ask if that is textually on purpose, that that option is open for interpretation to the audience. Why? I guess to get you to consider, oh, the misunderstandings of the adults have a serious impact on the kids and put them at risk.
Sure.
Yeah.
But if we walk down that path, that means that Minato and Yori forming their own space was dangerous inherently because it put them in the situation that they were stuck in the landslide and in this option died. I refuse to believe that interpretation because that by like the transitive property means that the creation of their own space was a bad outcome. And I do not believe that.
I'm going to use this argument against people. That was very well argued.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a very strong argument. And it would sort of go against the whole third act.
Yeah, and also the idea that they can save themselves, which I want to believe in this movie.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't know. He's also done that in the past, right? With like Nobody Knows.
That's true.
Yeah, that's true. He's gone real dark.
I think some people like tragedy in their films. You know what I mean? Like, tragedy sometimes makes things more beautiful for some people, but I don't.
And there exactly is a problem with, I mean, not that I'm one to be saying there's a problem with a lot of queer cinema, but there is a lot of queer cinema that ends in tragedy to make its point and draw pathos from a straight audience.
Yeah.
And I don't think that straight audiences should be pandered to like that and need to see the utmost tragedy or perfect characters in order to relate to queer stories, that we should be moving past that by now.
No, I agree. I agree.
I feel I'm going to tee up an argument in 2023 review episode that I'm not going to talk about now. I'm going to say there might be an argument.
Ben's going to be like, there should be no more queer movies.
Made.
Period.
No.
Period. Cut back to the end of our Carol episode.
I might talk about one of those movies you're talking about, Eli.
Oh, wait, like you're thinking of another director?
Like a Kill Your Gaze kind of movie.
Oh my God.
Maybe not Kill Your Gaze.
That's a trope. That's a trope.
Yeah. But more that they die, but sure. Maybe from a writing standpoint, Kill Your Gaze. Yeah.
Wait, okay, we'll leave it as a teaser, but off mic, tell me who you're thinking of.
Oh, no, wait for an episode.
Oh, I have to wait. I'm your co-host.
Oh, damn. He's got to be ready in the moment now.
Fine.
I think we can talk a little bit about the score, because this is Ryuichi Sakamoto's final score. But I didn't realize until after I watched it the first time, because I knew he scored it, but I didn't realize that it was just taken from his other music work prior and like just fit in.
I had a suspicion it might have been that.
I didn't know that.
But I do still think it's like gorgeous and super effective when it's used. I think the light piano works wonders. And then you really get to that horn section, or like what, I don't know how you describe that, but that sort of goes into that final bit with Minato running to their safe haven as the horns, or how do you call those instruments? Like those two instruments.
To me, I refuse to speak ill of Sakamoto, and I think that it is a very pretty score. I think it is most effective in the third go around of the story, which, you know, everything is more effective in that third passage.
Yeah.
But similarly to what I was saying about the coverage being kind of pat in those first two chapters, I think the score, when it comes in, feels a little too, it's a little simple.
Yeah.
It's kind of doing one thing and it's doing a very standard thing.
Yeah.
Sakamoto's great. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace. I'm worried that Koreeda and his cinematographer, Ryuto Kondo, are sort of falling into a house style.
I think they are.
Ooh, explain more.
Well, okay. Ryuto Kondo and Koreeda have worked on Shoplifters, The Makanai, which is his Netflix series, and this movie. And they all are very glossy, with very nice steady cam shots of people walking places. And it's like generally evenly lit scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Like I am just worrying that things just feel glossy. And it's not like Father Like Son. It's not like TV movie. Like, at least we're not in that horrible, horrible, horrible territory.
Still a good movie, though.
It's but a great movie.
No, I disagree.
It's a TV movie.
I don't like it. I do not like that movie.
I like it. It's my first Koreeda. I watched it on the plane.
Like, it's fine because I don't think Koreeda was always that visually oriented.
Mm-hmm.
But I wish more. Like, I feel like if anything could elevate his directing for me, is that it would be more intentional shot choices.
I've been thinking to this point all week about something that...
The quote.
Yeah. Who sent it?
So I sent it.
Something that Ben sent in our group chat. Ben, do you want to just describe what this was?
Yeah. So my last film of 2023, I watched Still Walking. And then, first of all, favorite Koreeda film.
Agreed.
We should have talked about it.
Agreed. We should do its own episode.
Maybe I'm about to do 30 minutes on Still Walking right now. But anyway.
Drop it.
So I decided to do some Googling and like just reading about the film and about the making of it. So I found this interview, I think, with Filmmaker Magazine and Koreeda about Still Walking. And he talks about how he had a conversation with Ho Xiaoxian, who watched his movie kindly and like gave him notes and like told him it was great.
Watched Mabaroshi, right?
Watched Mabaroshi, not Still Walking, years ago.
Oh my God.
And Ho Xiaoxian was like, did you storyboard the whole film before you shot it? Because it shows. And then he said, it's odd because you used to do documentary and you would know how to shoot people in their actual habitat. So you need to like see people before you can shoot people.
Right.
So Koreeda took that to heart really a lot. And then he decided that he stopped storyboarding and then he would go on to set and then find the scene and shoot the scene based on what the characters and actors were doing. So that's really interesting because that means that he had to switch. He changed the way that he thought that he would work in narrative film.
Right.
Because Mabaroshi was his first and he thought he had to work in a certain like filmic style that looks like film. And then I guess after that, realized that the documentary background that he had could still be used for narrative films and still feel like a movie. And of course, we're all very used to that because a lot of documentary shot movies are made.
But see, I'm thinking about this so much because there are Koreeda movies that are very visually patterned and there are ones that are not.
Mm. Okay.
Even in his post Mabaroshi era, which is the, you know, 99% of his career, right?
Like all of it.
Yeah. So
yeah,
Mabaroshi remains my favorite of his camera direction style movies and lighting movies.
Too.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It's just a really lovely to look at movie. And he uses distance so well. Setting the camera really far back from characters, it's very, very effective for what that movie is doing. And he does not return to that ever. But there are things like Still Walking and Shoplifters where he does have a very intentional and patterned camera style. And, you know, think about Ben's famous video essay where he talks about kind of dorsal framing of characters, right? He is very effective at choosing non-conventional angles for filming his characters, even while getting to that kind of documentary idea of responding to what the actor is doing in the moment, apparently.
Yeah.
In Monster, and certainly like Father Like Son, less so. And I connect a little bit less readily with those movies, I think, because the camera style is more pat.
You know what? I think Ho Xiaoxian saw Mabaroshi and got scared.
Got jealous.
He's like, this little shit is coming from my crown. And that's why he told him.
Gave him bad advice.
To storyboard. And that's why Ho Xiaoxian will forever be goated, in my opinion. King, I'm thinking of you. I love you. I love you, Ho Xiaoxian. I'm sending good vibes out there, hoping you're doing okay with family.
Oh, yeah.
Love you.
Okay, here's the thing. I am not a huge Ho Xiaoxian fan.
Nor I.
Fuck you.
I see that now, Wilson, and I also realize that I don't like Mabaroshi that much because it feels like a Ho Xiaoxian movie.
Huh.
Which is very ironic, right? Because I don't like the distance, because he's trying to tell this like story. And then he puts you at such a distance that I'm like, I need to close the gap. And it's a very beautiful movie. But in terms of what Koreeda himself is interested in, which is characters and feelings, the visual style is at odds with the way that he is and works as a director, which is why I think that was a mismatch. But
that tension is so interesting to me in Mamoroshi.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in thinking about why a movie's interesting and how it puts me at a distance. I want to just be in the movie.
Ben doesn't have enough time in the day.
We keep on coming back to this.
Like, I like to be in the movie. I don't like to be outside the movie. And I say that even though, like, I also love a lot of movies that use distance but keep you inside the movie. Even at a distance, it's very hard to describe the difference. It really depends on a movie.
Bookmark this for Anatomy of a Fall in our 2024 review. Coming back to this.
Mm-hmm. But I will argue that Still Walking, yes, is very patterned and has great choices with editing, shot choices. But I can argue that Still Walking is just a very well-covered movie with very smart editing in the back end.
Yeah, I would agree. Yep.
Because it's very simply shot. It's not crazy. It's not like exceptionally beautiful. The shots are very domestic and simple.
Yeah.
But a lot of the strength of Still Walking is in blocking.
Yes.
And the way that people talk.
Yes.
And the way that things are outside the frame and when things come into the frame. Yep, it's very strong when it does that.
Yeah.
And that's less about visual treatment and more about a good sense of what the scene is.
Right.
Huh.
So maybe with Monster, because the scenes have obfuscation baked in.
Yeah, true.
Then he gets confused. Like, it gets confusing to decide, like, where are you watching this from? Like, what information am I trying to tell you? Yeah.
Ooh, interesting.
But I do think something gets lost when he starts using Steadicam from, like, father, like, son onwards. Like, I think he gets Steadicam obsessed. And I think he just loves it because it helps you get nice coverage without having to, like, put things on sticks and be able to follow characters around. Like, I think it just makes things look glossy in not a nice way. I think if you think about something like Distance, right?
Oh, man. I forgot about this.
Distance is probably his most documentary looking film and with the zooms and everything and handheld cinematography. But I think that's like gorgeous. And I think you really feel like you're in that moment due to the documentary cinematography. But when you pair that sort of intention with something as sleek as a Steadicam, it's like, where are you? You're going in two different directions at the same time.
I wonder if he chooses it because it gets in the way of performance less. Like, it just allows actors to go do their thing while making an easy, unobtrusive camera choice. Like, you don't need multiple setups.
Yeah.
Maybe it's kind of like, both of you have not seen The Third Murder, which is not a good movie.
No.
But visually has some interesting stuff going on. And I think maybe he caters the visual style to if he thinks the movie needs it. And so I guess for Monster, he felt like it didn't. But then, like, you think about the ending of Monster, like, when it goes that kind of handheld, that's very different from the rest of the movie as well.
And overexposed.
Yeah, so I think maybe there is that intentionality. And then when he realizes that the scene is just, like, a people talking and it's not especially interesting, then he just kind of lets it be standard coverage, which maybe is not always the best way of going at things, but does make me feel like the visual stuff is a bit lackluster because it feels less intentional. It feels like, okay, let's just do coverage for this scene rather than like, let's do coverage, but why and who and from where? Like, those are important questions.
Yep. Well said.
Because coverage is not simple. You know, coverage can be intentional.
Yep.
Yeah. Like, it's something like Farhadi, right? We haven't even brought him up, but he, like, I feel like he's so close to this film because of how things play out and how things are told. But I think he does a lot of obfuscation as well, right? And either through camera or through dialogue. And I think his sort of semi-handheld documentary approach could really work for a story like this.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, and even, Ben, you mentioned that final stretch where they're running through the grasses. I think even that is Steadicam, not handheld.
Right.
Yeah, a little bumpy, shaky hand.
It's been a while since we've seen it, but I remember it feeling different from the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I'm not going to talk about Broker, but Broker also, even though not his usual DPs, also very TV, very almost like K-drama house style, let's just apply it to the film.
Huh.
Dude, like the grading on that film is like atrocious as well. I'm like, oh my God.
It's not even Netflix, but it's like 2000s TV.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's like really sucks, right? It really sucks because you have one of the best directors in the world, right? Like, who can work with actors and who can like really tell a story really effectively. And engagingly, but you have I hate to say it, right, but it's like he's not visually ambitious. He's not, that's not what he tries to do. But I like, that's my like big wish, my big hope, like please.
Think about Afterlife, which we cover in our podcast. Afterlife looks insane.
Oh, that's a beautiful movie.
It's so intentional.
Yeah.
And it's not flashy. It's very simple, but it's amazing. Like, I mean, just even the choices of the confessional shots towards camera, that's very intentional and repeated and patterned and works for the movie.
I really do feel like Netflix has been a pernicious force for homogenizing the visual look of movies across world cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and that's such a bummer. We did just talk about May December, which sort of weaponizes that standard TV movie look. Mm-hmm. Shout out Christopher Plavel. But
yeah,
on the whole, it really just has made things more bland, I feel, and less specific to cinematographer.
Because Netflix went to these places and it's like pumping money into those industries and giving filmmakers all the tools that they want. And then they're taking the money and they're doing all the tools. And then now, I think, are just gotten used to having all the toys. But actually, the limitations actually give you a chance to make something that looks a bit different from the usual TV stuff. Because now, obviously, the TV film distinction is gone.
Yeah.
You have films that premiere on TV and you watch on TV for the first time.
Yeah. I will say that despite the bumps and the things that we object to, this conversation really does remind me how much I love Kore-eda. And, you know, to remember Still Walking and Mabaroshi and Our Little Sister, which is maybe the one we haven't mentioned yet, Shoplifters, these are all movies that I really, really love. And even if this is not quite top shelf for me, that last passage especially is some of Kore-eda's best.
Yeah.
And he's maybe the best living director for working with child performances.
100%.
So kind and empathetic and gentle where it needs to be gentle.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Eli. And I think, like, I rat on this film a lot in this episode, but I still, like, I like, put it above so many other Kore-eda films, like, in my ranking. Like, I think it's maybe just behind Still Walking for me. And that's, like, second. Yeah. It's Mabaroshi, Still Walking, and then this. Mm. And then Afterlife after this.
Probably, Afterlife. Oh, man.
Yeah. The power of this movie, especially in the last act, is awe-inducing. Like, I think, especially watching it for the first time, you really are, like, Trojan horsed into this story. And I tell you, it took me by surprise like no other film did. And I think that I was so happy that it was not a revelation of like classic melodrama, which sort of reveals a sort of sadness. And it really could have gone that way. Like, I think there's such an easy way to turn this into a sad melodramatic story. But I think the decision to make it joyous and make it a celebration and make them happy. Mm-hmm. And that was what was revealed at the end. Like, I think so many of these mystery things are like, oh my God, he's like, I don't know, he lost like a brother and the brothers, like, I don't know. It's just like whenever these reveals happen in movies, that's like a horrible analogy. Whatever those like mystery films happen, the reveal is always like something that you dread. It's like something you least expect in the worst way possible. But when you sort of weaponize it for good, like, I think it unfortunately dims it on a second watch. Like, I don't think you're able to reach that joyous high that you get the first watch. But I think B gives you an experience that you don't really usually get at the movies or watching this kind of movie. So I think that's sort of what makes this film really stand out in Kore-eda's filmography and also the other films of the year. And that's why it's still up there. It's still top five for me this year.
Still top five.
I love Kore-eda, guys.
He's great.
I would love to talk about Still Walking for an entire episode.
Yeah, I'm totally down to do a full episode on that movie. That used to be my New Year's Day tradition. I would watch Still Walking for like a few years in a row. I did that.
That's such a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Great movie.
Yeah, I think it might actually just be my favorite movie, which is like easy.
Great pick.
Of all time.
Easy pick.
Very nice.
Yeah, I think it might be. Thinking about all my favorite movies and like thinking about how it is very simple and does a lot. And it's also not a typical film.
Yeah.
It's very like interestingly constructed compared to like any of actually Corrida's films.
And it also has some suppressive narration too, but yeah. handles it very differently.
Yeah.
Yeah. Corrida's a great man. He's a goat.
Yep.
He is the goat.
Bah,
bah. Thank you for listening to this episode of Deep Cut. Please rate and review us because that helps us keep making the show, and be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts so you'll know when our next episode drops. You can keep up with Deep Cut on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd at Deep Cut Pod. And you may join us to talk about movies on our Discord server, to which you'll find a link in the description. Deep Cut is hosted, produced, and edited by us, Wilson, Ben, and Eli. And our cover art is designed by Justina Yam, and our theme song is composed by Eli Sands.
I'm Wilson.
I'm Ben.
I'm Eli.
Take care, and we're looking forward to talking about more movies with you next time.